J.A. Charles. It's reel two. This is the 26th of June, 1980.
Okay, we're away.
Well, you'll recall that I said there were two problems in St. Hyde. One was the problem of the Quebec heaters and the fire. And we had the fire, and that was great. We didn't have anybody hurt, and we wrote off all the lost stores. And that was a real education. The other problem was that St. Hyacinth, Fancy Santh, was the first stop on the Ocean Limited from Montreal to Halifax. And you'll recall that, you know, everything was expanding and it was wartime. So there were either people on leave in Montreal or people joining their first units, all pre-services. And they usually rolled on board that Ocean Limited in Montreal, which I think left about 8 o'clock at night. And any of them were causing a fuss or causing any problem for the conductors, they kicked them off at St. Hyacinth. And so every night we had the patrol wagon down at the station to pick up the...
Then they gave you a problem.
Yeah.
executive officer.
Yeah, that's right. Was one of my problems. And I sure got an insight into the problems that people ran into in Montreal. Most of them were just exuberant young people who had consumed too much alcohol. And so we took them off the train and put them in the brig for the night to sober them up. And I would see them as defaulters in the morning, and we'd put them on the next train to Halifax. But that was practically every day of the week, I think. So it was a real introduction to the naval service men of all shapes, sizes, ranks, and...
But you accommodated all the services.
Yeah, that's right. The conductors, they weren't picky or choosy.
No.
they weren't having them on their train. And that was simple. So that was quite an experience. And I must say I admired this fellow, Pappy Musgrave, the way he handled the Canadian youth. He treated them in a very fair, sensible way without getting involved in any of the military... He followed the military form of discipline, but was really a very reasonable, sensible fellow. And it was a great education to see how he handled all the various types of cases we had. Other than that, St. Hyacinth, of course, was about 90% French-speaking when we went there. The garment mills, the mills that produced clothing, were there, and quite a number of the managers were English-speaking, but they all spoke French. And in fact, if you went down to the market or anywhere else, you pretty well had to speak French if you wanted to buy anything. So it was a quick education and, or an update on your schoolboy French in the practical terms of living in the community. I found the people absolutely delightful. We had no problems at all. And I must say they were very friendly to us, and I thoroughly enjoyed going out with the French-speaking community and in their homes. Particularly over the Christmas season, and this was the first Christmas I spent ashore, they have, of course, a very Roman Catholic community. And they followed all the traditions of midnight mass and then coming back for dinner after midnight mass and literally staying up all Christmas Eve. And I can't say that I found any problems that people encountered later on during the conscription crisis at that time. And we got along very well. I, of course, had to deal with the local police. The chief police spoke a certain amount of English, but I rapidly found that I could converse to a certain degree in French. And it was a good arrangement. Well, I wasn't there very long. The only other... I mentioned two characters. One was Musgrave. The other was the director of the signal division, Sam Worth, G.A. Worth. And Sam... who I was literally to relieve years later, remained in charge of the signal division. He ran it with an iron hand. He was the boss, and he had control over it. And that was the branch of the service that I was about to join. And Sam was a real good fellow. Again, he was an RCN officer who had left in 1928 or 29. I think one of the reasons he incurred the displeasure of the local admiral by bringing one of the local tarts from Halifax to an Admiralty House ball.
that could do it, yeah.
He had a great ability to think lightly of all the sort of, what you might call, traditional forms of naval life other than the actual service. But as a serving fellow in charge of the signal division, he ran a very good shop, and he was a great fellow to work for. And there were no grays with Sam. It was black and white. He was either support you or you were out, you know. He didn't carry fools gladly at all. So Sam was another bright spot on the horizon who I thoroughly enjoyed working for.
How many people would staff this school, and how many students would you have?
Well, when we were there to start with, we were only training the junior rates, the young Canadian ordinary signalmen, ordinary telegraphists, and coders. And so the staff of the school was quite small. There were Bobby Murdoch, who lives here in Victoria now, was a qualified signal officer. He'd just come back from his course. And there were a number of the ex-branch officers who had been promoted to warrant officers and lieutenants from commissioned rank. Doug Carroll, the telegraphist, John Hall, who lives here in Victoria, was the signal bulletin. And so the officers who were doing this training were all Canadians at that time. And the men were senior rates. We had about 10 or 12 RN, chief petty officers, on loan to help us with the training of the men. So the staff of the school was really quite small. I'm talking now, when you include the supply officer and the doctor and the dentist, the wardroom, I think there were about 20 of us in the wardroom. And the chiefs and day officers, instructors, there must have been about 25 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the number of students was about 400, 450. So that's the size it was at that time. Now, when I went back later on, it had increased in tremendously. All the senior rates, in other words, when he became a telegraphist or a signalman and had some experience, then he went and did a course at the signal school in England. And so he got his senior rates course in England, as that was so in all the other senior rates in the other, the gunnery, the torpedo,
mm-hmm.
the anti-submarine, the same, principal class. So I spent the winter at the school, and it was a pleasant break, really was. We could nip off to Montreal, and I was still a bachelor, and life was really quite enjoyable. But I was ready to go again. I figured that, you know, this wasn't really fighting the war. And so I was very pleased when we were told to go and join a merchant ship, and I forget what the name of the one was this time. But O'Brien, my contemporary from RMC, and I had been selected to do this long signal course in the UK, and we went down and joined the ship in Montreal. Sorry, in Halifax we joined our ship, to go over to the UK. It was a liner. I'm sorry, I can't remember that. There were, on board, they had a battalion of the Howard. It was a battalion that had been in Bermuda, anyway. Most of the officers whom were married and their wives were in the ship. There were four of us, myself and O'Brien, a RCN supply officer called Mullen, Tufty Mullen, and an RN commander who had been commander of the Prince of Wales. joined the ship, and the rest of the ship was full of Canadian nurses.
Oh, well, that must have been a pretty tough trip for you, fellas, eh?
Son of a gun. God's sake. And I think we were about 9 days going across. And it still wasn't a troop ship. In other words, although we were carrying military personnel, but the bars were open and, you know. Mm-hmm. And we sat down to dinner. We weren't dressing for dinner or anything like that, but it was rather like a peacetime trip. And for us, it was a real busman holiday.
Oh, sure.
We thoroughly enjoyed this. We had no responsibility.
They didn't put you to work anyway, yeah.
No, they didn't. So it was a pleasant holiday, and most of these girls were Canadians from all over Canada. And I should say that most of them had never been out of Canada before. Certainly, the number who had been in the ship was minimal. And they were a bit reserved and, and I suppose frightened a bit in the thought of going across. But after
were they medical corps? Excuse me, medical corps, or were they?
Practically all medical corps, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, they were. And therefore they were officer status, and they were.
Yeah.
But after the third or fourth day, they felt that we should enjoy this thing. And so we had a great time with dances and things like that. But as I say, the number of male unattached in the ship were rather minimal.
You had a field day, didn't
you? Well, I don't know the field day. I was literally dancing all night with different partners, which is a unique experience. But it was a pleasant trip. We had no problem over it. It was really quite calm for that time of year. And it was in March of 1942. And we were told to report to the RN Signal School, HMS Mercury it's called, and it had been moved out of Portsmouth, where we did our subs courses after the bombing, and it was now in Lady Peel's country house, at Lady Dean, which is near Petersfield, on the London-Portsmouth rail line. This long course that we were to do involved instruction in communications, which included on what they call the visual signaling world, which is flags, lights, and all the tactics, the conduct of the fleet, the tactics, and the way you handle the fleet, maneuver it, and indeed organize it. The other side of the coin was the telegraphy side. And that involved going through all of the equipment that was in use in the RN at that time, certainly doing radio theory and practical maintenance of radio equipment. And it also included some radar and, of course, codes and ciphers and all the matters related to communications in the RN at the time. The course included, there were 11 lieutenants, of which O'Brien and I were by far the junior, and one soldier from the Royal Corps of Signals, G.B. Sutherland. Well, he was a qualified Sigmund, but he was the start of the trend towards combined ops.
Oh.
So G.B. knew all about the radio equipment, and he wasn't particularly interested in the visual tactics, so he was a very bright fellow, a lot of fun. So he was a real spark on the course. Good sense of humor. The course included two Canadians, and the rest were British. Of the RN types, there were four serving admirals' sons on the course. Which was other.
I forgot to say. Yeah.
James, Somerville, Geyer, and Woodley. Lee. Wait a minute. Well, of course, we worked pretty hard at it. In this country house, we were rather remote from any of the activities, although we were on the flypath for the bombers to London. But it was in the country. It was a huge, big, typical stately home of England sort of business. The administration offices and the wardroom and the mess and everything were in the building, and we lived in cabins or what were the old rooms in the house, you know, for weekend guests. Two to a cabin. O'Brien and I shared a room. And we were the senior course there. There were a large number of other courses being run. They had built a lot of Nissen huts, and the classrooms were in Nissen huts and that sort of thing. There was a Wren officer's course. There was a RNVR signal, short signal course. And then there were all sorts of men, including the senior chiefs and petty officers, mm-hmm. petty officers, different senior rates. There were quite a number of Canadian senior rates there. So the working day was from 8 o'clock on Monday morning through till noon on Saturday. We worked a full week, and we were free on the weekends, except that every 11th weekend you were duty, and you were the fire watcher and the, you know, the mm-hmm. air raid precautions officer, I guess was the expression they used in those days. So you got up on the roof whenever the bombers came around to make sure all the fire buckets and the things that you used to put out fires from the incendiary bombs were there.
The stirrup pumps and the sand.
All that stuff.
Yeah. You had, presumably you had a duty watch at the same time. They run around with you, I suppose.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. They would divide it up.
Yeah.
It wasn't an arduous task, and so we were fairly free. Well, Brian and I went to London practically every weekend, usually to the theater and the show, and then we'd come back either on the early Monday morning train or sometimes on the Sunday. And in the middle of that, O'Brien decided to get married. And he got married in August, which was rather an unusual wedding. O'Brien was an RC from the province of Quebec. He came from Montreal. And, of course, the girl he was marrying, Stephanie, was C of E. And so he wanted to be married, or she wanted to be married in St. Martin in the Field, in Trafalgar Square. And the RC people weren't having any of that at all.
No, not those days.
Well, we spent a lot of time hassling over this rather legal problem, and we used to meet in the Mayfair bar with a French-Canadian lawyer in the Canadian Army to try and straighten out this problem. But in the long run, there was no way around it, so Scott decided to get married in the C of E church, and that was it. Rather unique thing about the wedding was it was right next, of course, to the Admiralty. And I was best man at this wedding. And then in the middle of the wedding, the admirals and the admiralty, they were all there in uniform, decided they were going to form an arch of swords. So I had to rush out to Moss Bros and get a cricket bag full of swords.
Yeah.
Get back. And as the wedding was over, I was dishing out swords literally from the first sea lower down when they were standing in this arch. And there was a second front rally now going on in Trafalgar Square. They all stopped second front rally and joined the
wedding party.
We had the whole of Trafalgar Square full of it was good fun. So O'Brien got married and moved out, and so Kit James moved in with me, and he and I shared a cabin for the rest of the course. And that's all that really happened during that time. It was enjoyable. We had a good group of people, and
I still don't quite see what this Army signals officer was doing there. He already knew all about the wireless. He was learning the procedure, was he?
The idea was they were beginning to build up the combined ops. In fact, I think Mountbatten had just been appointed in combined ops. And the Dieppe raid, of course, occurred during this, while we were on this course, but prior to that, there had been a few raids, Spitsbergen and Lofoten, and one or two others. So they were trying to build up a core of people who could work with the other services in the system. Mm-hmm. So that's
new, new both methods and both.
Yes, that's yeah. right. And indeed to try and marry the thing so we could work together, because as I'll explain later, I ran into this in a very big way in future operations. So GB was there. He wasn't particularly interested in the tactics, but he was interested in the procedure we used, the equipment we had, and the methods and the standards, so that there was a way of marrying the thing together. Mm-hmm. I ran into him later. He was the signal officer for the commander on Bark Acid South in Sicily. So he'd been, after he left from here, he'd been employed right in the job.
Oh, I see, yeah.
He had an old car, and this Lady Peel's house was up on a high hill. It had a magnificent view. It looks out over the and the Sussex town. And we get in this car, the pub down at the bottom of the hill. We'd get down to it all right, but it would always run down, but invariably we couldn't get it started to come home. That was always good for a couple more beers at the pub.
Yeah. You gave up easily, didn't you?
Yeah. He was a very tolerant pub keeper.
Were all the pipes on this course RN or RCN or Australian?
They were all regular.
They were all regular.
And indeed quite a number of senior ones.
Yeah.
They were all lieutenants. But the senior one was Raymond Dreyer, and he had about six years in as a lieutenant. So they were a pretty experienced group of people.
Yeah.
Had a lot of wartime experience, but very able people. So the course went on, and I'll mention here, just in my recollection of the Dieppe thing. After the Dieppe raid, Vine and I were in London, and we ran into some of our contemporaries from RMC, Denny Whittaker in particular, who was in the Hamilton Light Infantry, and there were two or three others, I guess. Anyway, they were very bitter about the thing at the time. I don't know how Denny feels about it now. I haven't seen him for some time. But they felt the planning had been very badly done. And I recall feeling, again, a lack of confidence in the way things were being run. Now, the Canadians, London was beginning to fill up. The Americans were beginning to arrive. This was in the summer of 42. And it was creating a certain amount of, it was, you know, a large number of people wandering around London on weekends, and the Canadians had been there for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Strange enough, there were very few British people. They were either in the Middle East or anyway, there didn't seem to be many in London. But there were Poles and French and Norwegians and Dutch and Danes. And, Stephanie's mother was mixed up in the officers, what's called the Foreign Officers Club, anyway, which she went and helped in the entertainment of the foreigners. And the masses of people were there in all uniforms. It was astounding.
Really.
But the fellow felt bitter about the planning of the Dieppe raid. There was no doubt about that. Or that was my recollection of the event.
Mention one other odd thing here. I see I got pictures. The king came to visit Mercury at the time, and my reaction, it got the impression from the papers that the royal family had been going around to the bombed out areas, and certainly they were terribly popular in the UK, but I found this was quite surprising to me. It was very precise and detailed. It wasn't a casual sort of thing at all. Outwardly, I suppose it did appear to be so. But the detailed planning that was involved in this royal visit was...
Getting them there.
Yeah.
When they were there, they appeared quite relaxed.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
And I think probably they were, but the amount of detail that was involved in planning it was the first time I'd run into this. And I was surprised how much it involved. And although they...
appeared to be casual. It was not an easy contact thing, mm-hmm. although they were terribly popular.
I see. I suppose by like all royal visits, there's an awful lot of background stuff that goes on to make sure that...
Well, this is the first time I've run into that. I ran into them a great deal much later on, but for the average public, you think, you know, the thing just goes slow as easy, and think there's an awful lot of... Or this is the first time I ran into the detailed planning it was involved in.
The king will greet three officers, you and you, and make it look like it's casual. You just happen to be there, but God help you if you're not, eh?
Yeah, that sort of thing. Yeah. Well, the court's finished sometime about the end of October, and I think we had a week's leave. And then we were appointed to our new jobs. And I was appointed as signal officer in the 19th Destroyer Flotilla, and the leader of the flotilla was Lafori. And this was the L-class destroyers. The flotilla consisted of Lafori, Lightning, Loyal, Lookout, Lawn, Lance, Legion, Lavender. Hmm. Normally the Ion built those things in eights, of which one was a bit bigger than the others. It had accommodation for the Captain D, who was a four-ring captain, and he carried the staff of a signal officer, a torpedo officer, and a navigator, who, in addition to being his advisors, also were responsible for their department in all the other ships in the flotilla. So you had a training problem and a supervision problem of not only your own department, but also the other ships in the flotilla.
Which were you?
I was Lafori.
Okay.
The Captain D, who was Tubby Hutton, a four-ring RN captain, and a very senior one. In fact, he was the senior Captain D in the Mediterranean when we got out there. Very senior captain. He was about 45. I'll mention here,
Were you in the leaders? You were the Captain D signal officer.
Yeah, that's
you?
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was this unusual to put a fellow straight off the course into that job?
No.
Was it the way they did it in order to find out how good you were?
Yeah, that's right.
Before they let you go off on your own somewhere else.
They sometimes sent them to other jobs, but the Canadians, we were asking for seagoing jobs. The gunnery officers tended to go to the bigger ships, the cruisers and things like that. But in our case, I guess Mickey went, Bobby didn't, but Mickey went to, B.G. Armstrong, and Scruff went to Quilliam, which was the leader of the Q's, out to the Far East. I'll explain about these destroyers. They were the last of the pre-war design, and it was rather an odd flotilla. The four L's, Lafori, Lightning, Lookout, and Loyal, were a step beyond the first four, which was Lively Land. The first four had four-inch guns, and they were rather like Jarvis and Kipling, the J's and the K's. But the big four L's, they had four seven-inch guns in turrets.
4.7 inch
guns in turrets, and the were HALA guns. They could cock right up to about 85, 90 degrees. Now, the reason I mention this is because these ships had commissioned in 1941, I guess, so they were designed before the war. The Canadians were all enthusiastic about the tribal class destroyers. And we went on building tribal-class destroyers up into 43, 44. And I never understood why we didn't go to these, because these were much better ships. And I speak of experience because, in fact, I ended up as CO of Haida, the original Haida, in Korea later on. And we indeed quite frequently had tribals under our command when we were in the Med. The tribals were designed to operate in the North Sea, and they had 4.7-inch guns, that's true, but they weren't in turrets, and they would only cock up so high. And they were nasty guns to fight in bad weather,
and they weren't very good anti-aircraft guns. And in addition, no ships had three boilers, whereas, and so they required additional people, and they had short legs, you know, they didn't carry much fuel. So the L's were much better. Now, strange enough, the Australians, they bought the M's, which was the next lot to the L's. They were like the L's. They were the best, in my mind, the best pre-war design destroyers the RM had built. They were a very fine ship. So I was delighted to go to this. Now, also, going with a senior captain D like that, it brought me a wealth of experience because we were always in charge of all the destroyers. It wasn't just one flotilla. We'd have sometimes three or four flotillas. It also produced some headaches for me, too, but it was great value from that point of view. I joined it. Now, I also point out that in this ship, in comparison, for example, with Canadian destroyers at the time, we had a senior RN Captain D who had been in destroyer practice all his life. He'd been commander when A.B. Cunningham was R.A.D. He'd been his commander, so he was an A.B. Cunningham man, too. The first lieutenant was Johnny Kempton. He was a lieutenant commander, a senior, experienced, a very able officer. I, again, was by far the junior officer in the ship. They were all regular force officers in the ship, except that we had a sub-lieutenant, RMDR, Ticehurst, and even the doctor was RN.
Really?
And we had an RNVR radar officer. But all the rest of the officers in the ship were RN, and all senior to me, they were all experienced officers. So the level of confidence and experience in the ship was quite noticeable.
What a way to learn.
It was good that. So I joined the ship in Portsmouth. It was a Portsmouth ship, with a Portsmouth crew. We did a short work up in Portsmouth. Then we went up to Scapa Flow and did some more workups, gunnery firings, did a couple of exercises with the home fleet. And but we knew we were just dying for the med. And so we sailed with KMF-5, which was a fast troop convoy bound for Algiers. This was a follow-up troop convoy for the landing to North Africa, which had taken place just early in November. So we were the follow-up convoy. It wasn't a big convoy. We had a lot of troops. Now these ships were troop ships. They were packed with troops. And we sailed, I think, on the 13th of December. And we went way out into the Atlantic, and we were pretty fast. And we went into Gibraltar on the... We went into Gib to fuel while the convoy went through the strait on the 19th of December. And that was, we came and rejoined the convoy. The convoy went through the straits just at dark, you know, normally the convoys went through. And it's about 250 miles from Gibraltar to Algiers. And it was flat, calm, beautiful moonlight night. And so we safely went along all that day, and the next evening, just before we were due to get into Algiers, where we were attacked with Italian torpedo aircraft, and one of the torpedoes hit one of the troop ships, the Straff Allen. We were then, at that time, 50 miles from Algiers. So we sent the rest of the convoy on, and tried to get this troop ship into Algiers. It was carrying very nearly 5,000 troops. The torpedo had hit in the boiler room. For some reason, I don't know why, the boiler room crew had not turned off the sprayers. The water rose in the boiler room. Oil on the surface of the bilges caught fire, and so the ship was on fire. They had no water.
So we took, this is a 3,500-ton destroyer, took in tow this 35,000-ton merchant ship. Fortunately, it was flat calm. And started towing it towards Algiers. And the other two destroyers, Lightning and Loyal, we put alongside the merchant ship to use their firemen to try and put out the fire. But it was a losing battle, and so eventually it came a point we had to take the troops off. Prior to this, they had gone to a bit of a panic in the ship, and there were some women on board. There were Wrens, and Eisenhower's secretary, Kay Summersby, was one of these women. There were about 50 or 60 women working. They were going as part of the staff at Algiers. And they put them in the lifeboat, and somehow they dipped it over, and some of these were in the water. And we had a submarine contact at the time, and you get into that terrible decision, you know, whether you drop the depth charges. Well, now that was Dee's decision to decide to fire, and he did fire, and I think we hurt some of the girls in the water. I don't know. Lightning picked them up, anyway. Well, now we had a problem of what to do with very nearly 5,000 troops. So we gradually, we told all the soldiers they had to throw away their rifles and small. They couldn't bring anything with them, just what they were standing in, and that was it. And we got about over 1,500 in each destroyer. And we had them right down in the soldiers, but sent a lot of people. And we took the last load off. And in fact, just after we left the ship, it turned over and sank. It was a pity to lose such a big ship like that. But you noticed in the ship that if you put the helm over just a little bit, it would heel over, and then it'd be terribly slow in coming back.
Your stability was really fixed, with all that extra weight.
Fortunately, it was flat calm, and so we took these people into Algiers and unloaded them. As soon as we got there, which was the 20th or the 21st, I'm a bit confused about the dates. I think it must have been the 21st we got into Algiers. Anyway, we were ordered right back to sea again, and we fueled and went down. And I'll mention here, on the way out, of course, we had this we were senior officer of the escort of the convoy. And the convoys ran under what we called convoy communication methods, which were different from fleet methods, although the flags were basically the same. But there was a different procedure. You had what you called the convoy instructions, and the convoy maneuvers and everything were set up to deal with merchant ship convoys, and they were different from fleet maneuvers. And, of course, I'd had quite a bit of experience with this in the North Atlantic, and I got along fine with my D. He thought I really knew what the hell I was doing. I was great, and I was just flying.
Yeah.
Well, when we left Algiers, we went down to Mirza El Kabir, which is beside Oran. It's west of Algiers, and there was the 4th H, which was the large fleet unit there, just coming out. We were to join them. And because we were senior D, we were senior officer of the escort, and there were 24 flaming destroyers just coming out. And I didn't even know the names of the destroyers, you know. And D said, organize the screen. Well, you know, yep. And we did it all by light and flags. We didn't use wireless there, hardly at all. Well, that was a real come down for me. And a hard way to learn.
Right.
But,
yeah. I guess it was.
So off we went with this bunch of battles. At that time, James Somerville was flag officer, 4th H. Strange enough, his son was on the course with it.
Oh, yeah.
We headed north up by the Balearic Islands. There was a sweep to try to lure out the Italian fleet. And Darlan was murdered or assassinated on December the 25th, Christmas Day. And so that caused a great kerfuffle. Nobody knew exactly what was going to happen in France. Nobody knew what was going to happen to the French fleet. So we stumbled around there for another 3 or 4 days. I remember one interesting thing about this. We had this great screen of destroyer going this way, and there were two battleships and two carriers, and I forget how many cruisers in this organization. And at night, north of the Balearics, which is fairly well up towards the French coast, the signal officer, Samuel's signal officer, anyway, he keyed on the low power LF, about 425 kc's, blue 1/8 IMI, blue 1/8, which meant that you turned 180 degrees and went back the other way. They used to call these things the tramlines, the ships would go up and down. And when that happened, when it was executed, the destroyers all turned and rushed like mad and got ahead of the ships as they were turning. Well, somehow or other, we missed this message, and so we rapidly, by this time we had radar, but we saw what was happening. The battleships were going that way, and the destroyers were
going the other way.
So we got it straightened out. We took them back to Gib, and this must have been about the 27th or 28th of December. And so I got a message, and this was my real start of thing. Signal officer D-19 report on board Rodney forthwith. And so I went over, and I was greeted by this great man, James Somerville. And he wanted to know why the hell I'd missed this message.
Oh, boy.
To me, I said, a lot of my time after that, appearing before various but at least I got to know the ball anyway. There was always argued in the area that, you know, that was the only way you could do anything. Do something wrong. Then you can come to somebody's attention. So we left this great Fourth H, much to my delight, and set off for a place called Bona. I think it's called Albana or something now in the new Algerian damage. But Bona was a port up close to the Algerian-Tunisian border. And as you recall, the First Army, that's the British First Army, and the Americans, army had moved east from Algiers and had got to about the Algerian-Tunisian border, and there they were stopped. And Bone was the main supply base for this gallant bunch of soldiers. And we joined, when we got there, an organization called Force K. Which it consisted of cruisers and destroyers, and the aim in this group was, first of all, to carry out sweeps into the Sicilian Narrows to intercept supply ships going from Sicily to North Africa to supply the German forces in North Africa, both the ones that are fighting on the east end, also, of course, the people who are fighting against Montgomery on the other end. And the other thing we had to do was provide air defense for this place at Bone, because there was practically no air defense there at all, except what was in the ship. So we arrived there on December the 31st in the afternoon, and we had a nice New Year's Eve party that night, having settled in this rather attractive little place. The desert doesn't come right up to the coast there. There's a lovely green belt that extends alongside the North African coast. And we wondered why everything was so quiet and all the other ships. But we found out about 4 o'clock in the morning, just at dawn, the air raid started. And they went on for 5 days. I counted that we had 37 air raids during that period. The first ones were Stukas, and I swear I could stand on the bridge of the ship, and I could have thrown a baseball and hit they came so low.
They came
so
low.
You know, you could see the pilots' faces in the airplane. Other funny thing about errage in an open bridge in a ship. There you are. You're standing on the bridge. It isn't as though you can go and run in a trench or jump in a ditch. I mean, you're there.
You're right
out
in the open.
Yeah. Nowhere to jump. So you get rather blasé about this business after a while. You just stand up there on the bridge and watch them come. Well, on this first raid, we were lying alongside a merchant ship. The idea of the warships would berth outside the merchant ships, and you'd provide DA fire for the merchant ship. And a stick of bombs came down out of a stupor. There were four bombs. You could see them leave the airplane. And we knew there were about 500-pound bombs and that sort of thing. And they went whoomp, whoomp, and one landed off our quarter and blew the electric power breakers off the board. But fortunately, it didn't damage the ship. And another one hit this merchant ship. And another one hit the jetty. It was a stick.
A pretty good straddle, I
guess.
Yeah,
that's right. Done pretty well.
Yeah.
But the one on the jetty went off. But there was no bang in the merchant ship. So after the airplane went back, the captain of the merchant ship went on air. D sang over to him and said, "Are you hit?" And the fellow said, "Yeah, it seems as though I got an unexploded bomb in my hold." And D said, "What are you carrying?" He said, "Ammunition and ammunition fuel." Two things happened. He turned to the torpedo officer, who, like me, had just done a long course in torpedo, and the people who were responsible for bomb disposal were the torpedo officers. He turned to him and he said, "You go over and deal with that unexploded bomb." And he said, "First attempt, let go all lines."
Yeah.
You never seen the sailors move so fast, no
more like fastest slip on the radar.
Yeah. But there wasn't much place to go. They hit about five ships that day. There was a tanker moored in the outer harbor where people, what they call Mediterranean moor. You go in stern first and put your lines out to the jetty that way and drop your anchor down. And there was a tanker there, and they did him, and he just went up like nothing. Lightning, one of the other ships, now I could tell, he was lying stern to the wall this way, at right angle to him. And so he said, "The hell with this, I'll get out of here." He went full ahead with his anchor down. And he came back, and his whole side was just covered with black and oil from this tanker, because the oil...